Really, beginning on page 215, my responsibility is to introduce to you part two and part three of this book, this little-known book. Now, you must understand that when Christian History, the Constitution, Volume 1, was put out, that took you, in effect, from primitive Christianity up to 1775. And then when Volume 2 came out, it went back into ancient civilization before primitive Christianity and took you up to 1775 again. Except it took a different sweep, and it went deeper, and it added one element, the whole concept of union. How do people work together to form a nation? Now, our biblical presupposition, our biblical principle for this whole section is what, class? What's the biblical basis for Christian self-government with union? Unity. What biblical reference are we working from? Matthew 22, 36 through 40. Christ's two great commandments. All right? Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, and mind, and thy neighbor as thyself. Now, this section begins on page 215. I am going to be referring to sections to it, but what I want to do is to perhaps answer one of the questions on the board that was on the board in my way, and it'll be answered again and again as you think of these things. You're a homeschool teacher. You're a mom. You're a dad. Teacher, administrator. I have no pastors here, to my knowledge. Why? Why study the law of nations? What's it mean to me? So what? Perhaps you noticed on the front page of the newspaper out here that we have under discussion, and I haven't been reading it, but I just saw that headline, that we have under discussion in this country and in other countries the apartheid situation in South Africa. All right. Now, here is something that individuals in this nation and other nations say this is not a good thing. Now, is there a rule, is there a law whereby we may govern ourselves with regard to what goes on in another nation that we like or we don't like? Reverse the situation. We had our form of apartheid, however you wish to define that, perhaps what, anywhere from 50 to 100 years ago. How would we want another nation who did not want that or like that or practiced it and endorsed it conduct themselves with regard to our situation? Now, there are laws of nations that are extremely important. Now, you consider, for example, the internal and external implications of Christ's two commandments. Consider it for your own home, your own church, your own state, and your own nations. Now, number one, I submit that we're, as parents, raising up citizens. Yes, we want them to be Christians. We want them to be Christian citizens. Now, these citizens are going to direct, under God's providence, the course of human events. Aren't we directing the course of human events? Or does it appear we're directing the course of human events and God is doing it? However you wish to say, my decisions and my actions are going to have something to do with the course of human events. Now, will your children, am I, are you, and will our children be making decisions that are going to affect the peace of nations? That's the question. Are my children going to be making political decisions, moral decisions, economic decisions that are going to affect the peace of nations? I look at my own family. Does Jason make decisions today that affects peace between he and his brother and sisters? Or Matthew, or any of them? Are my decisions affecting the peace or effecting warfare within the family? Now, if my decisions and their decisions and your decisions have that impact, do you think they might affect peace or war between nations? Consider that your children, by the grace of God, might become one of those statesmen that we so desire, a potential representative, or at least a citizen who is going to select those representatives who are going to be in the position of voting yay or nay on some treaty. that is going to affect your very life, your very liberty, and your very property. In effect, they're going to be in positions of authority and responsibility whereby they're going to have to deal with other nations from the principles that have been planted within them, either in diplomacy or in warfare, either peacefully, either with peaceful nations or hostile nations. And they're going to be making decisions for our good or for our harm. Yes, as a nation, but indeed as individuals. In effect, it says the governments make war. Indeed. And what's the seed? What's the source and origin of those decisions? That determines war between nations. One of the individuals of the three that we're going to discuss, Hugo Grotius, Samuel Pufendorf, and Emil Vattel, a Dutchman, a German, and a Frenchman, literally wrote extensively on the law of nations because there was much warfare in their time. And actually, Grotius's first thing was on the law. Let's see, what was the title? Out on the top of my head initially. The Rights of War and Peace in three books, as it says here over on page 233. The Rights of War and Peace. Now, consider what we implant and what we teach in our classrooms is going to produce citizens whose political decisions are going to affect peace between nations. Some of these citizens are going to be electing representatives or becoming representatives who are going to be making critical decisions concerning peace or war between nations. Yeah, I think it's wiser to do it. We've used this symbol often. Miss Stang's favorite symbol would be, I think, the upside down and the right side up pyramid. What's right side up for her? It's upside down for the others. You know how that goes. Okay, we have this symbol. And we're dealing here again with our presupposition, Christ's two great commandments. They include all the law and the prophets. Man's relationship between God, man's relationship between man. We know, very simply, this refers to an internal relationship. This is external. This is a relationship that describes Christian self-government. And this is a relationship that depicts the union that we have as a result of this. This, you might say, seems to describe, this vertical relationship describes a picture of unity. And this describes an external expression of that union. So let's start from scratch, so to speak, here. We have this picture. This is internal. It's a picture of unity. Man is properly self-governed when he's governed by God. In this relationship between God, he has relationships with men, women. All right, in his own home, he has relationships with other homes. In his own church, he has relationships within that church with other churches. And then he has his own community, state, and finally nation. And there are vertical and horizontal relationships throughout all of life and living. It is, in effect, a dual form of government. There's a duality, two levels, in all of life and living. Our immediate, internal, unseen relationship between God and man and between another. And once we have that right relationship, we have, in effect, within ourselves, we take into our home, and each individual takes within their home, that sense of unity. And that brings it out between mom and dad, between children within the home. So if this could be a picture of an expansion of that, what is actually taking place within the heart of the individual in this relationship is going to have its expression. And you take this into your heart literally, all the way down the line, and it has its expression in the home. The heart of that individual goes right into the church. And his decisions will affect his relationship not only within that church, but between other churches, i.e. between other bodies of whatever persuasion, and then into his community and so forth. You remember this picture. When Grotius is used to define the Christian principle of self-government, he started with that man cannot govern well a kingdom. That cannot govern what? Province. And not that, a village. That cannot govern, what was the one, a family? I think the city. And then a family. And then himself. And reason. Be lord, will and appetite are vassals, but reason cannot be lord until truly it is brought into obedience and governed by God. Now we have this picture again of God in control of the individual. And hence, if the government of God is in control of the individual, then God is using that individual to make a difference in the family. We look at cause and effect from this point. If God is causative of what I do, both in and outside of me, the government of God in me is going to become causative of what I do in the family. The family that I'm in is going to become a cause for whatever good effect is going to take place in our town. Whatever takes place in our town is going to become causative of the good or evil effect in our county. What the county does through our representatives is going to be causative of any good or evil effect in terms of our state. And what the state does in turn will become good or evil effect in our nation. In this picture of concentric circles, we have this idea, yes, God is ultimate cause. In him all power lieth to affect all of these. And we see at once that as God works through individuals, the flow of power is out. And when the nation takes some action, it's coming right back upon us. When the state takes some action, it comes back upon us. And the county and all level. In effect, we see these important decisions made within our heart is affecting each of these spheres, and then this becomes causative of that. This becomes causative of that. There's cause and effect all the way through. And yet, it's holistic. We see this individual making decisions at once that not only affect the family, but then he retreats and considers, and he's making decisions that affect the city, the town, and then the county. Do you see what I'm driving at here? There's a cause and effect relationship here, but then again, the individual is affecting, making decisions and producing good effect at once within himself and outside of himself on all these levels. And then you have the relationship between nations. Our individual nation. This is an individual. But this is an individual. And this becomes an individual. God works through individuals to affect each expanding sphere of government. God can use this nation, bless it, judge it for its individual decisions in relationship to other nations. God can use this individual nation out here to begin judgment or blessing on other nations, our own. You with me? I'll ponder that. Now we go back to the simplest foundations here when we begin to understand the law of nations. Christ's two commandments, man's relationship between God and man. The first commandment, the second commandment. This very simple idea is going to be discussed in one way or another and applied in one way or another by the following three authors that we're going to identify. Say, my, this is certainly heavy stuff. Again, I trust you have a reason for devoting your time and attention to considering this important, really vitally important aspect of the law of nations. Let me introduce, first of all, a few simple definitions that might help us understand the vocabulary used by these 16th and 17th century authors. When you think of nature, what do you think of? What's the common thing? What do you think of nature? What do you think of? Birds and bees. That's very good. Birds and bees. What were you going to say, Lady Harris? Creation, huh? It's what you look upon. That's nature. Don't fool with Mother Nature. You'd be turned into butter or whatever it is. The aspect here, when you think of nature, by definition, Webster's 1828. Now look at the understanding that was held among the founding fathers of the time. Nature is the author of created things. It is God, the author of created things. That was one definition. Second definition of nature is the operations of his power. It's the operations of his power. It's the outworking of what he's doing. Or, literally, it's all the works of God. Nature is all the works of God. So, what then is natural? Gee, I don't know if we ought to use this for natural foods. But we say it's pertaining to nature. That which is natural is pertaining to nature. I must remember you folks over here. You can't see through me. That which is produced by the laws of growth, whatever is produced, that which is produced by the laws, rules of growth, whatever appears to make it grow, whatever appears to make it form, formation, growth, formation, or motion. It's moving. All right. Impressed on bodies, or beings, he says, bodies or beings, by divine power. It's the power of God. It's the government of God we see that is behind the invisible, unseen government of God is literally responsible for those laws of growth, formation, or motion impressed on bodies or beings by divine power. That's natural. Because we're going to be introduced to a very interesting concept that seems to be a stone of stumbling among our brethren, which Mary Elaine, bless her heart and scholarship, is going to document in some detail when she discusses John Locke. And this is this concept of the law of nature. Now, you know what that refers to, right? The law of nature is what? It's God's law. They define it as the will of God. All right. Now we're going to be dealing with the law of nations. What is the law of nations? Now you're going to get Grotius's point of view. He's going to make a distinction. The law of nature is different from the law of nations. Samuel Pufendorf is going to say, nope, the law of nature and the law of nations is one law. Emile Vattel is going to also reason from these two aspects and come to a conclusion concerning the law of nations. Now, with this introduction, let's go into our authors and see, first of all, what the father of the law of nations, how he identified this. Hugh de Groot. Hugh de Groot, or better known as, what is it? Hugo Grotius. Hugo Grotius. Hugh de Groot, 1583 to 1645. Is there a date closest to this that gives you something to to identify him with. What happened in 1588, class? Spanish Armada. All right, so he was 5 years old when the Spanish Armada was going along. It was the Duke de Parma who had his troops in Holland, ready, of course, for the Spanish ships to meet up with him, bring him over to England when he was 5 years old. So that's where he is, 1645. What happened in 1620? What happened in 1630? Puritans, okay? So you see his standing here. Now, let's look at, basically, his youth. Now, I'll give you a quick outline. He's born in Delft, Holland. His father was the curator of the University of Leiden. Why is the University of Leiden important to America's Christian history? John Robinson was also a professor there at the time, okay? And his father was curator of the University of Leiden. He was a lawyer and a poet, a very apparently known poet. Turn to page 239. Let's get a picture of Hugo Grotius's immense early faculties here. Page 239. First full paragraph. The mind of Grotius was developed with unusual rapidity. In his 9th year, he is said to have made extemporaneous Latin verses. In his 15th year, he published his edition of Marsh and Capella. And before that time, his biographers state that he disputed twice publicly before he was 15 in the schools on questions of philosophy and civil law. His memory is said to have been so prodigious that being present at the muster of a regiment on some particular occasion, he afterwards repeated accurately every name which had been called. Antidotes of this kind are seldom to be traced to any good authority and are frequently merely fabulous, but there is no doubt that at a very tender age, Grotius had made extraordinary progress in the acquisition of learning. And it said, that, as you go down here, another 4 or 5 lines, at the age of 15, the editor must have read critically and carefully, the works of, you got it? And that one? Cicero, Aquila, Porphyry, is that it? Aristotle, Strabo, Ptolemy, Pliny, Euclid, and many other ancient and modern authors in different languages and on various subjects, and cannot fail to consider Grotius as a wonderful instance of early talents, industry, and acquirement. Indeed. At 12 years of age, it says in the top, he was sent to the University of Leiden, where he remained only 3 years. All right. At age 15, he published a book on training seamen, how to find where they were at sea, and apparently how to determine latitude and longitude. He, at 15 about, traveled to France with the Grand Pensionary of Holland, a very famous individual, Barnevelt, I believe it is, and on a diplomatic mission. And by the age of 18, he was accepted at The Hague. At The Hague, is that it? Which is apparently the seat of government there in Holland. By the time he was 24 years old, he was nominated the Advocate General of the province of Holland and Zeeland, which he ruled over in that capacity at a very young age. Now, he was very experienced in law, of course, a very critical student of law and of literature. He helped, without success, apparently, to resolve a dispute between England and Holland. And because some provinces were upset with regard to the rule of the King of Holland at that time, he was involved in writing up some instructions that these provinces used to contest the rule of the king. And subsequently, the king took issue with that and banished him from office, and later was arrested for having raised an insurrection, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment. Well, in prison, he started writing his De Jure Bella. In prison, this is his statement concerning the law of nations. He was sentenced there for life. At first, his father, his wife could not visit him, but thereafter, they consented to let his wife visit him so long as she resided in prison with him full time. Subsequently, she could not get out, but then, of course, with all the considerable laundry and all the things that have to be done that a wife could do, the prison officials ought not to have to do, she was permitted to leave about twice a week. And she could take out, of course, some things and go get some books for him, so he had time to consider and reflect. Well, later, His wife helped him to escape. She got through the guards, of course, with this trunk of old dirty laundry and books and so forth. So often, they did not inspect it. A few holes were drilled, and he was snuggled in there, and the guards carried this same old trunk out, and he subsequently escaped. And he escaped to Paris, France, where he finished his work on the Law of Nations in 1625, called The Rights of War and Peace. Now, Grotius was also a thorough student of the Scriptures. If you would, please, turn to page 247. In prison is where he made a thorough study of the Sermon on the Mount and the whole Christian religion. Page 247, I'd like to point out the first full paragraph there. This is his observation on the power of Christianity. Notice how God works in his view. We come next to examine in what manner the Christian religion made such a progress that in this particular also it may be compared with others. We see most men are disposed to comply with the examples of kings and rulers, especially if they be obliged to it by law or compelled by force. To these, the religions of the pagans and that of the Mohammedans owe their increase. In other words, they're compelled into it. They're forced, in effect. It's by decree they come. But they who first taught the Christian religion were not only men without any authority, but of low fortune, fishers, tent makers, and the like. And yet, by the industry of these men, that doctrine within 30 years or thereabouts spread not only through all parts of the Roman Empire, but as far as the Parthians and Indians. And not only in the very beginning, but for almost 300 years, by the industry of private persons, without any threats, without any enticements, nay, opposed as much as possible by the power of those who were in authority, this religion was propagated so far that it possessed the greatest part of the Roman Empire before Constantine professed Christianity. What's the point here, class? What principle does this not only imply, but explicitly endorse? Concept of voluntary Christian action, voluntary union. It wasn't done by those in authority. They were opposed by those in authority. But Christianity spread voluntarily and began to permeate the empire. All right, let's consider some of his views on the rights of war and peace. Just a few taste of them so you can get into it. The preface here is reprinted beginning in page 252. Would you turn to 256? Page 256. Paragraphs are nicely numbered for us. Turn to paragraph 29. I'm sorry. Let's see. 256. Yes, 256, paragraph 29. Now, for my part, being fully assured by the reasons I have already given, that there is some right common to all nations. Now, think big, folks. There's some right common to all children in my family, some right common to all members within my church, some right common between the two cities within my county. I do have an old, old version, don't I? Catherine and I are condemned. Well, folks, is it 29? Oh, yours... I'm sorry, I'm on 257. What are you on? Did I? I did initially say 256. I'm sorry. Yes, I'm okay. Now I'm on 257. Are we on the same page? All right, so we can follow. Some common right to all nations, which takes place both in the preparations and in the course of war. I had many and weighty reasons inducing me to write a treatise upon it. What did he observe? I observed throughout the Christian world a licentiousness in regard to war, which even barbarous nations ought to be ashamed of. What were they doing? A running to arms upon every frivolous, or rather no, occasions, which being once taken up, there remained no longer any reverence for right, either divine or human, just as if from that time, from the time of war, men were authorized and firmly resolved to commit all manner of crimes without restraint. Now, the spectacle of which monstrous barbarity worked many, and those in no wise bad men, up into an opinion that a Christian, whose duty consists principally in loving all men without exception, ought not at all to bear arms. That's one view, with whom seem to agree sometimes Johannes Fyrdus, and our countryman Erasmus, men that were great lovers of peace, both ecclesiastical and civil. But I suppose they had the same view as those have who, in order to make things that are crooked straight, usually bend them as much the other way. But this very endeavor of inclining too much to the opposite extremes is so far from doing good that it often does hurt. All you have to do, you see, is just love all men, whether even if they're going to kill you. You just love them to pieces. All right? That's the extreme. All right? So this is so far from doing good that it often does hurt, because men readily discovering things that are urged too far by them are apt to slight their authority in other matters, which perhaps are more reasonable. A cure, therefore, was to be appealed to both these, as well to prevent believing that nothing, as that all things, are lawful. So nations do go to war. There are rules of warfare. And I was amazed as I again reviewed this and learned again just how barbarous nations were in warfare. Now consider, we don't like war. It's hell, indeed, and it appears to be barbarous. Men kill each other, take their property, plunder. But from what we know of war today, this is tame, considering the medieval times and ancient times. We're far more civilized in our warfare today than they were in terms of how they dealt with people. Look on page 259 for a second, and paragraph 41. I have likewise, toward the proof of this law, made use of the testimonies of philosophers, historians, poets, and in the last place, orators. And one thing that distinguished Grotius, he documented far back in history for the first time that of any time of anyone, all the individuals who had anything to say on the law of nations. He codified this whole concept. The first to articulate the law of nations is documented in great detail, and he tells you who he documented. Let's go down to the colon, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 4 lines down. But that when many men of different times and places unanimously affirm the same thing for truth, this ought to be ascribed to a general cause, which in the questions treated by us can be no other than either a just inference drawn from the principles of nature or an universal consent. So principles of nature involve consent among nations. The former, principles of nature, shows the law of nature. And the other, universal consent, shows the law of nations. All right? Now, we'll summarize this briefly. But he's saying the principles of nature, the principles of God, constitute the law of nature. And the universal, tacit consent constitutes the law of nations. So the laws of God constitute the law of nature, Grotius says. On the other hand, it's universal, tacit, passive consent, in his view, in his study, constituted the law of nations. Tacit. Universal tacit consent. That's the law of nations. He knows the law of God. The principles of nature constitute the law of nature. All right? Now let's look next at Samuel Pufendorf. I thought it was Puffendorf, but Miss Slater corrected me. It's Pufendorf. I'll take her word for it. Samuel Pufendorf, 1631 to 1694. On the heels here of Grotius, right? Grotius is Dutch, Pufendorf is German. Brief background, born in Germany and a thorough student of German public law or civil law. At the age of 37, he was invited to tutor the son of a Swedish nobleman. This nobleman was the ambassador from Sweden to Denmark. And so Pufendorf was asked to come to Denmark and to become the tutor for his son. He went to Copenhagen. When he got there, war broke out between Denmark and Sweden. Consequently, the whole family including Pufendorf, was thrown into prison. And he was suffered to be in solitude, no books, nothing to read. Well, fortunately, he had read Grotius. And without the book, he had pencil and paper, or whatever they wrote at the time, he began to reflect upon what he had read from memory and to begin to write out his comments and observations. And he did this entirely for his own amusement, incidentally. When he was finally released with the family, either through a period of peace or treaty, he eventually published this. He shared it. People liked it. It was published. And an individual in Germany read it and said, "This is so good. I want you to come over to Germany now and to tutor this electoral prince, this, in effect, an heir who was who could have been a prince or a ruler in Germany." He did this for a while, and at age 49, he went to Sweden, back to Sweden, and became professor of the law of nature and nations in Sweden. So with that brief background here, born in Germany, but actually exercising most of his scholarship in Sweden, let's examine some of his observations. First of all, page 266. Both Grotius and Pufendorf were read by our founding fathers. Now, when people, as Mary Lane will point out, spurn the idea of Locke having a particular emphasis in American history, let's understand that he was widely read, Locke was. So was Grotius and Pufendorf. All these quotes on page 66, I wish to bring to your attention here, are references from James Otis, Samuel Adams, James Wilson, Alexander Hamilton, and others. Turn to page, Benjamin Franklin. Look at this quote just by Franklin in 1749, early before the American Revolution. "Thus may the first principles of sound politics be fixed in the minds of youth. Grotius, Pufendorf, and some other writers of the same kind may be used." They were read. They were understood. They were not even read because Franklin and Otis and others considered themselves to be a separate nation. They never thought that they were going to divorce themselves from England. They were reading it because it was the law of nations, and they were part of the English nation, and they ought to be knowledgeable of these things so that they can properly represent England when asked, or perhaps concur or disagree with what England does as she acts with regard to other nations. Now, let's look at his biblical reasoning. Turn to page 270. Few excerpts from the Law of Nature and Nations, page 270. Look at the first full paragraph. "Amongst the opinions, then, which it highly concerns all men to settle and to embrace, the chief are those which relate to Almighty God as the great creator and governor of the universe, that there is really existing a supreme being from whom all other things derive their original and the principle of their motion. Not as from a dull and senseless power, as the weight, for example, in a clock, but as from a cause endued with understanding and with freedom of choice, that this eternal being exercises a sovereignty not only over the whole world, or over mankind in general, but over every individual human person, whose knowledge nothing can escape, who, by virtue of his imperial right, hath enjoined men such certain duties by natural law, the observance of which will meet with his approbation, the breach or the neglect with his displeasure, and that he will, for this purpose, require an exact account from every man of his proceedings without corruption and without partiality. Now, the next paragraph, as the main parts of human duty turn on this belief, so is it, this belief, this conviction in God, the only foundation of that sweet tranquility and acquiescence of mind which men inwardly enjoy, and the very fence and bulwark of all that probity which we are to exercise towards our neighbor." What's he talking about here, class? This is really a commentary on Christ's two great commandments. All right. Look at page 280. First of all, 274. Second full paragraph. "That saying of our Savior in which he commands us to love our neighbor as ourselves, seems not so fitly to be interpreted by the degree of love as of the truth and sincerity of that love. Inasmuch as no man dissembles or counterfeits a passion towards himself. And that phrase, as thyself, looks like a proverbial speech, importing a sincere and hearty kindness. But should we take the expression in the highest sense, it would scarce follow, not so, that supposing the love of ourselves and of our neighbor not capable in some instance of being answered both together, the former, love of self, ought to yield to the latter. Nor are the proofs, which we find sometimes alleged from Exodus 23 and Deuteronomy 22, sufficient to evince, that the love of our neighbor ought to take place before our own real advantage. For cannot thence be gathered that we are first to help our neighbor's beast out of the ditch, if our own be in the same condition, or that we are obliged to give such assistance, when the business we must neglect for that good office is of more consequence than the thing we thus endeavor to save or rescue for another. And besides all this, it may very fairly be questioned whether a person who assaults us in a violent manner ought to keep the title of a neighbor, as the word seems to be meant in our Savior's command. Is he a good neighbor who attempts to take your life? Then ought you to love him as you love yourself. Now, this is pretty deep reasoning. Love your neighbor as yourself. What's the loving thing to do when your neighbor assaults you? Yield. You love yourself. Love him as you love yourself. That's all right. I don't know how they would rationalize that. He's saying that ought not to be. All right. Turn to page 280. Pardon? Top of the page. 280. From this obligation by which men are bound to pay obedience unto God. All right? We have an obligation to obey God. From that obligation to obey God springs the obligation of all men towards all men as such, by virtue of which they are engaged to lead a social life. Christ's second commandment is a social commandment. Christ's second commandment is a political commandment. Christ's second commandment is an educational. It's a cultural commandment, literally. That is to say, the commandment is implemented in all phases of life and living. Now, what's the differences between Grotius and Pufendorf on their view of the law of nature and nations? All right, about the outline form, it's very, very thin. Let's contrast the differences here. Turn to page 238. Now, Grotius came first. He's the father. Pufendorf comes along, reads Grotius, and improves upon him. Man by the name of Barbrek. Is that correct, Mary Lane? Pardon? You got that? Barbira. Okay, Barbira. Every time I'll say it, it'll change, so I better say it. It's the way she said it. 1729, wrote a preface to Pufendorf. All right, and he does a beautiful job. Look on the first full paragraph. Mr. Pufendorf, says Barbire, whatever, often refutes Grotius. And that, too, with reason. I mean that pretended distinction of his between the law of nature and a certain law of nations. Remember, Grotius says there's a difference. Which he conceives to be founded, the law of nations, to be conceived to be founded on the tacit consent of the people of those several nations. I have no design to derogate in the least from the glory of the great man, who is far above all my encomiums. We should not, perhaps, even at this day, have had any tolerable system of the science of the law of nature had it not been for the light he has given us. And had Mr. Pufendorf been in the place of Grotius, and Grotius in the place of Mr. Pufendorf, the work, de jure belli, whatever, would, in my opinion, have been much more imperfect than it is. And the other, de jure gentium and whatever, much more perfect. I say it once again that I never entertained a thought of diverting anyone from reading the book of Grotius. Very far from it. I am heartily sorry, out of the goodwill I bear to the Republic of Letters, that this excellent work is so wretchedly translated into our language. Now, what I want to point you to is the marginal notes. It's a very well-defined contrast here. Grotius saw the law of nature and the law of nations as two separate laws. The law of nature was obligatory and is as binding as the will of God, right? The law of nations was founded upon the consent of the people of the nation. They agreed that we as a nation would conduct ourselves this way with regard to another nation by consent. They consented to the kings doing it this way or to the princes who are in control. And they either consented because they didn't say anything, primarily tacit, or they expressed their will. All right? Now, Pufendorf maintained that the law of nature and the law of nations as the one law in origin and authority is the will of God. All right? Grotius, law of nature is the law of nature and nations are separate. Separate laws, all right? The law of nature is obligatory. It obliges us to obey. It's as obligatory as the will of God. That's his will, obey. But he found, as he studied history, that the law of nations was different. It's founded upon tacit consent, or passive consent. Pufendorf, on the other hand, in his law, he said the law of nature and law of nations is one. Which do you think is correct? They're one in their origin. They both come from the same origin. And they're both one in terms of their authority. Come from the same authority. Which is more reasonable to you? Pardon? Pufendorf seems to be, you say? The law of nature and the law of nations is one in their origin and authority. Both laws are obligatory. Both laws are obligatory as commands of God, all right? Look at the bottom of page 238. James Wilson was one of the leading constitutional thinkers of our country, contemporary of the time of the founding fathers. Notice his summary here. By the way, he says, to bottom of 238, we may here observe that with regard to the law of nations, Grotius and Pufendorf seem to have run into contrary extremes. Grotius was of the opinion that the whole law of nations took its origin and authority from consent. Pufendorf was of the opinion that every part of the law of nations was the same with the law of nature, that no part of it could receive its obligatory force from consent. Pufendorf thought that the law of nature and the law of nations were precisely the same. Go down to the last four or five lines. Though the law of nations, properly so called, be a part of the law of nature, though it spring from the same source, and though it is attended with the same obligatory power, yet it must be remembered that its application, the application of the first and second law, is made to very different objects. The law of nature is applied to individuals. The law of nations is applied to states. Does that ring true? The first commandment is applied to whom? To individual man. And the second commandment is applied to in effect, other individuals in relationship to that one, all right, or to states of being, you might say. Now, time remaining, let's look at Vettel. Emmerich. Emmerich, 1714 to 1767. He's French. I don't have a historical sketch on him, but let's take a look at his work on the principles of the law of nature. Principles of the law of nature. Our explicit rendering. Look at page 288. Again, Vattel. A little bit more contemporary with the founding fathers. Lived only about age 53. The others lived much longer. Vattel is well quoted, thoroughly quoted. Otis, Samuel Adams, James Wilson, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison. And again, Benjamin Franklin. Turn to page 290. This is fascinating. In italics, note this quote from Benjamin Franklin in a letter to Dumas in 1775. I am much obliged by the kind present you have made to us of your editions of Vattel. It came to us in good season, when the circumstances of a rising state make it necessary frequently to consult the law of nations. Accordingly, that copy which I kept, after depositing one in our own public library here, and sending the other to the College of Massachusetts Bay, as you directed, has been continually in the hands of the members of our Congress now sitting, who are much pleased with your notes and preface, and have entertained a high and just esteem for their author. All three of these authors were read in detail by our founding fathers. So, what is the law of nations? First question here. Vattel puts it this way, third paragraph down, page 290. To establish on a solid foundation the obligations and laws of nations, it is the design of this work. The law of nations is the science of the law subsisting between nations and states and of the obligations that flow from it. All right. Let's look over here as page 291. This is beautiful reading, incidentally. You'd be blessed if you walked through it. I think you'd find many personal applications. I certainly did. Sift this observation on 291, first full paragraph, or is it second full paragraph, applies. We must then apply to nations the rules of the law of nature in order to discover what are their obligations and what are their laws. Consequently, the law of nations is originally no more than the law of nature applied to nations. Good summary sentence. But as the application of a rule cannot be just and reasonable if it be not made in a manner suitable to the subject. You have children of different ages, different dispositions in your family. You have one body of law whereby you govern the whole. Do you not apply that rule perhaps a bit differently, although it's the same rule, to the children? Maybe you can do it. But you find that one's disposition, say, says that the rule is such, if it be broken, there might be one aspect, the way you would discipline a little bit differently than you would the other. All right? We are not to believe that the law of nations is precisely, and in every case, the same as the law of nature, the subjects of them only accepted, so that we need only substitute nations for individuals. Careful. A state or civil society is a subject very different from an individual of the human race, whence, in many cases, there follow, in virtue of the laws of nature themselves, very different obligations and rights. But the same general rule applied to two subjects, cannot produce exactly the same decisions when the subjects are different. Does this mean that they're playing favorites? Or is it just really a fact that the application of a law can have a different effect or a different rendering for individuals? Turn to page 293. Vattel says, in the first full paragraph, from hence it is deduced that natural society established among men, the general law of society is that each should do for others whatever their necessities require, and they are capable of doing, without neglecting what they owe to themselves. A law which all men ought to observe in order to live agreeably to their nature and in conformity to the views of their common Creator. A law that our own safety, our happiness, our most precious advantages ought to render sacred to every one of us. Such is the general obligation that binds us to the observance of our duty. Let us fulfill it with care, if we would wisely endeavor to promote our highest happiness. Page 294, he's summarizing again, first general law and second general law. Second full paragraph, 294. The first general law, which the very end of Society of Nations discovers, is that each nation ought to contribute all in its power to the happiness and perfection of others. Can you imagine a diplomat standing up and saying this to another nation? I mean, would that be trite, or would it be well received? Rather trite. And yet it's an attitude. We're dealing with attitudes within our diplomats, within ourselves. We ought to. But the duty towards ourselves, he continues, having incontestably the advantage over our duty with respect to others. Is that true? Your duty toward yourself has the advantage over your duty to others. You have some fine reasoning here. You say, well, I don't know. My duty to others is fine. Now, you think God, others, and me, right? Your duty towards yourself having incontestably the advantage over our duty with respect to others. A nation ought, in the first place, preferably to all other considerations, to do whatever it can to promote its own happiness and perfection. I say whatever it can, not only in a physical but in a moral sense, that is, what it can do lawfully and consistently with justice and integrity. When, therefore, it cannot contribute to the welfare of another without doing an essential injury to itself, the obligation ceases on this particular occasion, and the nation is considered as under an impossibility performing that office. Is this a new insight to you, with regard to how you conduct yourself, or with regard to how one nation conducts itself to another? Second law, nations being free and independent of each other, in the same manner as men are naturally free and independent, the second general law of their society is that each nation ought to be left in the peaceable enjoyment of that liberty it has derived from nature, from God. The natural society of nations cannot subsist if the rights each has received from nature are not respected. None would willingly renounce its liberty. It would rather break off all commerce with those that should attempt to violate it. Now, he will develop this, I think, in really interesting detail as you get into it. Now, this type of reading, what in the world are you going to do with it? It seems to deal with attitudes, and yet as you get into these men's works, they deal very specifically. When one nation goes to war, what general laws are to govern it when it's in war, much less in peace? All right? But primarily, he's dealing with the attitude, with a disposition that is taught by Christ's two commandments. It's just manifested as a nation in regard to another. Collection of individuals. Look, if you would, as a point of summary, over on page 299. Why should this be part of our study? both in the Pilgrim Institute, much less in our homes and schools and churches. We're not all going to be lawyers. Indeed, particularly as you consider reading Joseph Story's observations here, Story said, "There is yet another study which may well engage the attention of American lawyers and be in the language of Lord Coke, both honorable and profitable to them. I mean the study of the law of nations. This study is at all times the duty and ought to be the pride of all who aspire to be statesmen. Are we endeavoring to raise children who will be statesmen? If you are not a representative, can you be a statesman? Really? What ought a statesman to know? Biblical principles of God, man, and government, which involve the principles of nations, government between nations. All right, here's a good reason, folks. And as much as our lawyers, and as many of our lawyers, and as many of our own children become legislators, it seems to be the study of which, of all others, they should most seriously devote themselves. Independently of these considerations, there is nothing that can give so high a finish or so brilliant an ornament or so extensive an instruction as this pursuit to a professional education. What, indeed, can tend more to exalt and purify the mind than..." Now, here's what you do when you study the law of nations. "Speculations upon the origin and extent of moral obligations, upon the great truths and dictates of natural law, upon the immutable principles that regulate right and wrong in social and private life, and upon the just application of these to the intercourse and duties and contentions of independent nations. What can be a more transcendent dignity or better fitted to employ the highest faculties of genius and the development of those important truths which teach the duties of magistrates and peoples, the rights of peace and war, the limits of lawful hostility, the mutual duties of belligerent and neutral powers, and which aim at the introduction into national affairs of that benign spirit of Christian virtue, which tempers the exercise even of acknowledged rights with mercy, humanity, and delicacy." Top of page 300, "Yet how few have mastered the elementary treatises of this on this subject, the labors of Albericus Gentilis and Zorsch and Grotius and Pufendorf and Beinuckschuk and Wolfenus and whatever, and Vattel. How few have aspired even vision after those comprehensive researches in the law of nations." Folks, it's a law I have never really considered, and yet the law of nations is the law of a family. The law of nations is the law of the churches. The law of nations is the law between states. And the law of nations obviously involves relationships between our nation and others. The Christian spirit within us is manifested as the activity and relationships of our nation to another. Biblical principles are the same. The application is infinite.